My daughter had nothing but sweet things to... Well, she's full of energy. I hope she doesn't wear you out. Yeah, praise the Lord. We love her a lot. She's been such a blessing to us. Praise the Lord. Well, today we're going to continue our discussion of Egypt. We have only a few more things to tell you about the land of Egypt. And we could spend a lot more time talking about this land. It's a mysterious land. It's a really interesting land. And it's a culture that is certainly very, very unique. But we were talking about the city of Alexandria yesterday. We were saying that it was not the main city built at the time of Egypt's height, and it was really built from scratch later on by Alexander the Great. It was founded by him in 322 BC, and he did that in order to preserve Greek culture. We also mentioned that a few years later, many Jews moved into the northeast sector of the city. It became a very cosmopolitan city. But what we are really talking about is the fact that this major library was located there. 750,000 volumes were written and contained in this, and from that, a great university resulted. We also mentioned that there was a ruler called Ptolemy II, and he issued an order that his soldiers should search the ships when they came to Egypt, and that they were to seize any books that were found aboard those ships, and they were to copy them and then give a copy of the original book back to the owner. And that's how they got this library. And in fact, it's interesting that Ptolemy II was able to trick the Athenians. And the Athenians showed up, and they had their official copies of the tragedies. Now, those are Greek plays that they would go through, very popular, very famous plays. And they had the copies of the tragedies. And so what Ptolemy did, he gave them a deposit, gave them something like 15 talents of gold, and said, if you'll just let us copy these, well, we'll give you a deposit, and we'll give you back the original copies. So what Ptolemy did is then he got the original copies of the tragedies, the very copies from which the actors performed from. And then what he did, he said, now that I've got them, keep the deposit. You can have that, and I'll keep the originals. Thank you. And so he basically stole them and bought them for 15 talents of gold. And they were very, very valuable things in the minds of the Greeks. They used these copies in their plays, and they were highly sought after. Well, we also read historically now that in 285 BC, now maybe you have heard of this particular work, but in 285 BC, there was a Hebrew Old Testament translation called the Septuagint. And that was done in 285 BC. It's abbreviated by the Roman numerals LXX, which stands for 70. And that's what the word Septuagint means as well. It means 70. And the Septuagint was actually a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament scriptures. And the reason they needed to do this is because the Jews living in Alexandria at this time basically forgot how to speak in Hebrew because they weren't speaking in Hebrew any longer. And so they could not read their own Bible. And so they had to copy it over again in Greek. And that became a very, very common translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, and became probably the one that Paul used to preach the gospel from, and the rest of the apostles preached the gospel from worldwide, because this was a language that people could understand. Well, the peak population at this time was about 1 million people in Alexandria. Very amazing and ungodly culture. There were 4,000 public baths in Alexandria alone. There were 400 theaters plus parks and museums. And the city was around for hundreds and hundreds of years until finally the Muslims came down in about AD 641 and destroyed the city. And it's interesting, when they did that, the Muslims were very anti-learning in many regards, and so they destroyed the library. And what they did, they took all those choice volumes that had been collected over hundreds of years, and they used them to fire the public baths, to heat up the public baths. And there were enough books to keep the public baths heated for about 6 months. That's how many books there were, and they just burned them all up. And so that happened during that time as well. Now, of course, another major feature of Egyptian history and culture are the pyramids. Very interesting objects that have been built, very, very old. And actually, there's a line of pyramids that once stretched all the way from the head of the delta, where the Nile River flows into the Mediterranean Ocean, all the way down to almost the fifth and the sixth cataracts. So in other words, the entire length of the land of Egypt,
there were pyramids, and a lot of people aren't aware of that. They feel like, well, there's only three or whatever. They literally had hundreds of pyramids at one time. Many of them were destroyed. Many of them only partially remain, but several of them still remain in fairly good shape. Now, the pyramids were actually a center for what is called a necropolis. And a necropolis means the city of the dead. That's what the term means. And a necropolis is a cemetery. That's spelled N-E-C-R-O-P-O-L-I-S, necropolis. And really, a necropolis was a large, elaborate cemetery of an ancient city. And so not only was the pharaoh buried here and often in one of the pyramids, but the people of the city itself, as they died, they were buried in the same area right along with their pharaoh. And every single pyramid had a funeral temple that was connected with it, in which offerings were made on behalf of the entombed pharaoh within the pyramid itself. Now, the most famous pyramid group is called the Giza. Whenever you see pictures of the pyramid, it's called the Giza Pyramid Group. That's spelled G-I-Z-A. And this is the one that tourists see, and this is the one that occurs on postcards and in books. And there are actually, I believe, about three pyramids that are in this group. And they're very large, very massive pyramids. Now, they're also very, very ancient. It's very hard to date them exactly when they were built. They were probably built just within a number of hundreds of years after the flood. So whenever the flood occurred, they probably were built sometime after that, but not a long time after that. Most historians say that the great time of pyramid building was during the Egyptian Old Period, which would be dynasties 3 through 6. Dynasties 3 through 6. Now, that's way back, you know, before 2000 BC. And again, it's really hard to date that. But at any rate, the Israelites did not work on them. In fact, Abraham, when Abraham went down into the land of Egypt, he probably saw them, probably saw the pyramids, probably saw the Sphinx there. But the Israelites did not come into the land of Egypt until a little bit later in time. So they obviously did not work on these pyramids. And they were probably there maybe as early as maybe 3 to 5 centuries before Abraham even. The most famous one is the Great Pyramid of Khufu. That's the most famous of them all. It's the largest, spelled like this. It's also known as Cheops. And that's spelled K-H-U-F-U. And it's also spelled C-H-E-O-P-S. Probably built sometime roughly around 2500 B.C., maybe 2300 B.C. It's hard to tell, but we'll just tentatively date it 2500 B.C. with a big question mark there. But he was the founder of the 4th dynasty. He built this, the greatest of all pyramids. It's about 492 feet high at the highest point. And that's high. That's almost 500 feet tall, 492 feet high. It's about 755 feet square at the base, 755 feet square. Now, it covers about a total of 13 acres. To give you an idea, this chapel and so forth, all the buildings and the parking lot, and all the way up to 4th Avenue up there, that's about 8 acres. So this pyramid covers about 13 acres. That's almost twice that amount of land. It's built with over 2,300,000 blocks. And these are all solid blocks, 2,300,000 of them. The blocks weigh more than 2.5 tons apiece. Some of them are even a lot heavier than that. But the average about 2.5 tons apiece, I believe, most of them are made out of limestone, although the covering originally was made out of granite. And some of the structural stones inside are made out of solid granite as well. And the interesting thing is that the majority of the stones were quarried at an area called Aswan. And they were floated literally hundreds of miles downriver to the site of the pyramid. So they quarried them upstream, and they cut them upstream, many of them, and they quarried them down. Some of the choicer stones, like some of the inner granite working and so forth, the only quarry that they can find by chemical testing and so forth literally comes from thousands of miles away in the Mediterranean area. So they may have actually gotten their stone through trading or whatever and shipped them a couple thousand miles, some of the real important key valuable stones, shipped them down to the land of Egypt. It's actually unaffected by earthquakes, as the reason why it still stands today, because each stone at the bottom is carved according to the curvature of the earth. So the whole thing is fit. They actually moved all the topsoil and all the underlying soils, and they built the thing on solid bedrock of the earth, and they built the bottom of the pyramid is curved. And so evidently they had a knowledge and an understanding of the fact that the earth is round, and they knew that particular bit of knowledge. And so it has withstood all the earthquakes and everything else down through all that time. They were also able to lay out the 13-acre site so evenly that experts using modern instruments and transits and everything have found that the southeast corner of the pyramid stands only a half inch higher than the northwest corner, a half inch off. And see, we're talking about maybe 4,500 years of age. And this thing is that heavy. 2,300,000 stones. Now, you know there's a tendency for things to settle over time. And, you know, if you build even a room like this, a lot of times carpenters and construction workers, they'll build a room like this, and they'll be out of plumb a half inch on a room like this, or maybe like the chapel building or the sanctuary over there. They'll be out of plumb, and they just adjust everything accordingly. And yet, during that time, they built this huge pyramid, and it was that accurate. Sir Flinders Petrie said, quote, "The Pyramid of Cheops is the greatest and most accurate structure the world has ever seen." He was a famous Egyptian scientist. The Encyclopedia Britannica says, "The brain power to which it testifies is as great as that of any modern man because of all the knowledge that must have gone into building this particular thing." We could really say a lot about it. I think what I'll do is just draw a brief little sketch for you here and kind of show you some of the things that are inside of it. I read a real thick book on the pyramid one time. It was very fascinating. It described all the various explorers that explored it. A lot of people aren't aware of the fact that people tried literally for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years to try to get into this thing and couldn't get into the pyramid. They could not find how to get into it. And because all the massive stones and everything, they couldn't find the entrance into it. And it was built in a very ingenious way. But of course it has four sides to it like this. Now I need to really draw this a little bit up here. But it's built, basically what it amounts to, it's a big funeral tomb, a big mausoleum. It's a place for Khafre or Cheops to be buried in. But basically a solid rock is what it is. And inside the very middle of it, there's the actual burial tomb itself. And it kind of looks like this. None of this is to scale, obviously. And going up to it, there's what is called the Grand Gallery. This is a huge room. I forget how tall it is, but it's maybe, I forget what it is. It's something like 100 feet tall or whatever. It's huge, the Grand Gallery. And then the Grand Gallery ends, and that's the main access. And then there's another tunnel or pathway that continues on like this. And then all of a sudden it cuts up like this. And that was the entrance to it. It was covered over with stone and you could not find it. And then what they had, this was the burial chamber right there. And they had like five slabs of solid granite with a roof of solid granite to support the structure itself. If they just had one slab, all the stones would crush it. So they had it, and these are huge, huge, thick, solid granite slabs. They're still there today. And what they did when they built the thing, They built it with solid blocks of granite right in the Grand Gallery like this. Again, this isn't a scale. And they were tied with ropes and cables like that. And so after they built the thing, they cut the cables loose and all these things slid down the Grand Gallery and blocked this thing up with blocks of granite like that. And it was all blocked up. And then they had an escape hatch that went like this. I'll just kind of draw it here. They had like an escape tunnel that they literally slid the people that would have, you know, closed the tomb up. And then it came out something like this, just kind of cuts up and cuts up over to this exit right here, like that. And so what they did, they dropped the blocks down and then came down this long tunnel, climbed up and out this way. And this thing was just real hard to climb up again. So there's no way that anyone could get into the main burial chamber. And then what they did, they had air vents, two of them, that went up like this, and they had a second one that went up like this. And those air vents
kept the burial tomb at the precise temperature year-round. It was something like 68 degrees. And scientists have measured that with their calibrated instruments, and it varies like only 1 to 2 degrees throughout the entire year. And the whole thing was circulated with air, and this is where the pharaoh was to be buried. And the thing was almost impossible to find access into. After they built it, they covered the whole thing with granite slabs. And I read about a number of those slabs. They were so precise that they could not even put a knife in between the cuts of granite. And it's like they, just looking at it, standing far off, it looked like a solid sheet of granite. But the cuts were so accurate, they couldn't even wedge anything in between the cuts. Obviously, an incredible amount of physical labor was required to build something like this. Herodotus says 100,000 men worked for 20 years on this pyramid alone. 100,000 men. They used a number of different devices. They used things like the lever and the roller and the inclined plane for mechanical devices. And they also used copper saws. They've actually found the saws in the quarries, about 9-foot-long saws to cut the great blocks of stone out of. And they had a real unique way of breaking off the original stone. They would drill holes down into the stone, and they would drive green wedge sticks down into the holes that they drilled and pour water into the holes, and the sticks would swell, and they would crack off great blocks of stone, and then they would cut them square with these copper saws. And that is a lot of work. I know we laid a tile floor in our house, and we were cutting these little tile things, and we were cutting about an inch every 45 minutes, just like that. And I think of these blocks, 2.5 tons, cut square. And when you're all done, the thing is a half inch off after 4,500 years. And the way the whole thing is faced, like all the galleries and everything, this is much longer. This is not built to scale. But when this thing is opened up, it points to certain constellations at certain times of the year. And the whole thing is oriented according to the stars. And it's really an incredible piece of work. Obviously, some very, very intelligent, very knowledgeable people built that thing. Now, of course, the real significance of the pyramids has always been up in the air. Scientists aren't really certain why they were built. They basically know that they were probably built for a burial tomb for the pharaohs. That when the Muslims, who were the first to find their way into the tomb, when they entered, they found the sarcophagus, but the mummy was gone. And like the top was off, and it was a solid granite sarcophagus, as I remember, but the body had been plundered or taken a long time before that. And who broke in and who took that, no one knows. And over the years, the whole thing filled up with rubble and everything. And then the explorers that came in through this way, they had to chisel through all these solid blocks of granite. And I remember reading the account. It was just agonizing, time-consuming time. They had to chisel and chisel and chisel, and they would break through one block, and there'd be another one. And they'd chisel and chisel, and this stuff was extremely hard, very, very hard granite. And they'd chisel through that, and there'd be another plug. And plug after plug after plug after plug after plug. And when they finally broke the last one, there was a huge gush of air that came out. And it's like it was kind of a vacuum inside there. And all these things had been plugged up with rubble over the years. And when they cleaned it all out, the thing just maintained that even temperature. And so the pharaoh not only was preserved as far as his body, but it was also a perfect environment for him. See, and he would have lasted for a long, long period of time in that particular pyramid. Well, then there's another important archaeological discovery here. Two more that we're going to close the land of Egypt with. The next one is called the Rosetta Stone. Incidentally, on the last point, as far as the pyramid, some have seen that as a picture of prophecy and the plan of God, and a lot of people have written books on this, as far as the pyramid containing the plan of salvation. And I've seen the diagrams. The Jehovah Witnesses used to be big on this. The British Israelites in England used to be big on this. But they believe that God gave this as a sign to mankind as far as the gospel is concerned. And they had this all mysteriously figured out. They had it all measured out, that this tunnel here symbolized like man lost in sin. This tunnel here symbolizes man in the grand gallery awakening in his conscience to God. And this gallery here symbolizes man coming into the presence of God. And everything is measured and everything is symbolic. And let me just say, I think that they're probably reading into this pyramid something that is not really there. I don't really think that God would take a pagan nation like this that is so demonically oriented
And they were totally demonically oriented in their spiritual relationship with God. And used that as a witness of the plan of salvation. See, and they've actually got it figured down. They had dates as to when Jesus was going to come back again. And concerning how many feet to the ground central burial chamber and so forth. And really, I think they're just reading into it something that's not there. That's my opinion. Well, we move on to the next one. It's called the Rosetta Stone. It's spelled R-O-S-E-T-T-A. Extremely important archaeological find. And the reason why the Rosetta Stone, here's the key point that I want you to remember with it. The Rosetta Stone was the key to unlocking the Egyptian hieroglyphics. I'll spell that term for you in a moment on the board. But it was the key to unlocking the Egyptian hieroglyphics. Up to this point in time, no one could read the hieroglyphics. The hieroglyphics were basically picture language. They used pictures very similar to what the Chinese do. And the symbols symbolized something. They had like fish and they had all kinds of other symbols. And the symbol stood for a sound in their language, and when you put them all together, it would sound like their word if you knew how to pronounce it. But no one could decipher them, and so therefore they had all these burial chambers and everything that were written in hieroglyphics, and no one could read the writing in them. And this occurred for literally hundreds of years. But in 1798, there was a man called Napoleon Bonaparte. Remember him? Tried to conquer the world, tried to conquer Europe. Napoleon Bonaparte invaded the land of Egypt in 1798. And as the custom was during that time, he took with his army, more than 200 scholars and artists. This was during the time of the Renaissance and the period of Enlightenment. And they were looking for art treasures and scientific knowledge and so forth. He had these 200 scholars with him, and they happened to be digging a trench near the area of Rosetta in Egypt, which is near the mouth of the Nile River. And lo and behold, one of Napoleon's engineers, whose name was Bassand, found this strange-looking stone. And this was in 1799 that they found this stone. His name was Bassand. And immediately it caught his attention when he discovered this stone. Here's the actual discoverer of it. His name is Bassand. And that's spelled B-O-U-S-S-A-N-D. And he discovered this in 1799. And it's really not that large of an imposing stone. It's actually only about 3 feet 9 inches high. That's only about maybe 4 feet tall. And it's only about 2 feet 4 inches wide and only about 11 inches thick. And it's made out of solid black granite. But the thing that was really unique about it is that there was an inscription on it. There was a writing on it, and this was a trilingual inscription. There were 3 languages on it. And these were the 3 basic languages that were spoken throughout the history of the land of Egypt. Now, the first language was hieroglyphic. The second was demotic. Demotic. T instead of M. And then the last one was Koine Greek. The first two were Egyptian languages. The third one is actually a Greek language that was spoken in Egypt when the Ptolemies took over. But first of all, the hieroglyphic language was written there. That's spelled H-I-E-R-O-G-L-Y-P-H-I-C. And that was the holy writing of the ancient Egyptian scribes. This one right here. This is what the scribes used to write and record all their sacred writings in. And the pyramid texts were written with hieroglyphic writings. And the Book of the Dead. And whenever they wrote all the incaptions inside the tombs, they were all written in hieroglyphic. It was a special private language, as it were. The second one is called Demotic Egyptian language. That's spelled D-E-M-O-T-I-C. And that was a much later dialect. It was a common writing language that the common people would use to write with. So it was more versatile and more well known. And then the third language was Koine Greek, K-O-I-N-E. And that, of course, was a very familiar and well known language during the time of Jesus Christ. That's what the New Testament was written in, Koine Greek. So they discovered this stone in 1799, and they shipped it back to Europe. And when they got it back to Europe, of course, the Greek was easy to read. There's a lot of scholars that could read the Koine Greek. But the other two languages were a real mystery. And scholar after scholar tried for years to crack the code. And it was not until there was a scholar whose name was Champollion, and after 4 years of painstaking effort, he finally was able to break the code and decipher both of these two languages. And his name, if you're interested, spelled like this. And that was done in the years 1818 to 1822. So his name is spelled Champollion, Champollion, and that was from 1818 to 1822. So after about 20 years or 22 years of hard, diligent effort, they finally were able to crack the meaning of the inscription. And when they did that, they were actually able to then read all the temple tombs and all the writings on them. The stone was later taken to England, and there it stands today in the British Museum. But that unlocked everything as far as the ancient Greek writing. And basically, it was the same message in three different languages. But it took that many years to break this particular language. And incidentally, if you're wondering what was written on the stone, actually it was a commemoration stone. And it was commemorating the ascension of the Greek ruler Ptolemy Epiphanes to the throne of Egypt on March 27th, 196 BC. So it was written in commemoration of him. Also mentions Cleopatra in the stone as well, so that's interesting. Now let's talk about another and final archaeological discovery. Let's talk briefly about the Tell el Amarna tablets. That's spelled T-E-L-L-E-L-A-M-A-R-N-A, the Tell el Amarna tablets. Now, these were discovered back in 1888, and they were discovered actually accidentally. They were not discovered by an archaeologist. They were discovered by an elderly woman who was digging in the ruins of the city of Amarna, and she was just digging around in the rubble there, and she came across these clay tablets. In fact, there were about 300 of them. 300 clay tablets, and later they were called the Amarna letters because that's exactly what they are. They are actually letters. Now, the interesting thing is that they are inscribed in the Babylonian cuneiform writing. They're not written in the Egyptian language. They're written in Babylonian, which, of course, was not the language of Egypt. And they were part of the royal archives or the royal library of Amenhotep III and Amenhotep IV. These were pharaohs. So they were part of their as it were, royal library or archive, and also Amenhotep IV, his successor. And incidentally, the first one reigned sometime around 1400 BC. So they go all the way back to 1400 BC. Now, does that date ring a bell at all in your mind in connection with the Egyptian and Israelite history? Okay, it'd actually be about 50 years after the Exodus. The Exodus was probably around 1450 BC, which means that the Israelites would now be where? Well, actually, they'd actually be in the Promised Land by now, because they wandered for 40 years, see? So they'd be in the Promised Land for about 10 years approximately now. See, give whatever, but they'd be basically in the Promised Land. Well, these are actually letters written to these pharaohs, and they are pleas for help. That's what they are. They're SOS messages, 300 of them, and they're saying, help. And these are written by kings of Palestine and kings of Syria. And they're saying, there is a group of people and they are conquering us. And if you don't come and help us, we're going to perish. And they are literally pleas for help. They are Mayday letters. Mayday, Mayday. And the invaders, curiously enough, are called in the letters the Havaru. The Havaru, and of course, that would be the same as Hebrew. And I'm not sure if you remember, but we talked about the Mari tablets earlier, discovered over in Assyria and Syria, and the Mari tablets also mentioned, and they spell it the same way, the Habiru. That's spelled H-A-B-I-R-U, and the Habiru probably would be the Hebrews, or at least the Hebrews would be a portion of the Habiru. Now, there is one governor in particular that I'm going to mention, although there are other kings that are writing as well. His name is Abdi-Heba. And that's spelled A-B-D-I-H-I-B-A. He was the governor of Jerusalem. And he is writing to this Egyptian pharaoh, Amenhotep. I'm not sure if it's the third or fourth, but he's writing to Amenhotep. And he's saying, if you don't give me aid to battle against the Habiru, you're going to lose this country. And I'm willing to submit my country to you, but if you don't help me, you're going to lose everything. Let me read you the actual letters. You ever enjoy reading someone else's mail? Not any longer. Maybe when you were a kid, but you wouldn't do that any longer. There's something within man that he just is naturally curious. He likes to read the mail of other people. Well, let's read a couple letters from Abdi-Heba. Here's what he's writing to this pharaoh. He says, and I quote, these are actual translations off these tablets. He says, no lands of the king remain. The Habiru plunder all lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king, the Lord, will remain. But if archers are not here, then the lands of the king, my Lord, are lost. To the scribe of the king, my Lord, thus saith Abdi-Heba, thy servant, bring words plainly before the king, my Lord. All the lands of the king, my Lord, are going to ruin. So he's calling Pharaoh my Lord, see? And he's saying, now get this message to Pharaoh and tell him if he doesn't send archers this year, he's going to lose everything. But then it goes on and says, quote, verily, this land of Jerusalem... exactly how he calls it, Jerusalem, just kind of leaves the J off the front of it, but the land of Jerusalem, neither my father nor my mother has given it to me. The mighty hand of the king gave it to me. That is, he's saying, Pharaoh, you gave me this land. Verily, the king has set his name upon the land of Jerusalem forever. Therefore, he cannot abandon the lands of Jerusalem. Let the king care for his land. The land of the king will be lost. All of it will be taken from me. There is hostility to me, but now the Habiru are taking the cities of the king. If there are no archers this year, then let the king send a deputy, that he may take me to himself together with my brothers, and we will die with the king our Lord. So he's saying, if you're not going to send archers, then at least send someone to come and get me and take me back to Egypt, because we're going to lose everything to these Habiru. And this is the very time that the Hebrews were conquering the land of Palestine. And so I thought you might find that interesting. When you start putting all these finds together, there's confirmation after confirmation after confirmation from the spade of archaeology concerning the accuracy of the Word of God. Well, let me give you some final scriptures on Egypt, and I'll be really brief on this. I'm not going to take the time to read any of these except for one, maybe. And you don't necessarily need to write these all down, but first of all, Egypt is mentioned so often in the Bible, it's portrayed as a false refuge. Often the Israelites would trust in Egypt, but God is saying you're leaning on a broken reed that's going to pierce the palm of your hand. And you can read all the following scriptures if you would like. You can see Genesis chapter 12, verse 10, Genesis chapter 26, verse 2, and Genesis chapter 39, verse 1, and Genesis chapter 46, verse 3, and Exodus chapter 4, verse 19, and Isaiah chapter 30, and verse 2, and Isaiah chapter 31, verse 1, and Ezekiel chapter 17, verse 15, Ezekiel chapter 29, verse 6, and Ezekiel chapter 29, verse 16. Now you can also read prophecies about Nebuchadnezzar coming down and destroying Egypt and overcoming it. You can read about that in Jeremiah chapter 46, Jeremiah 46, 3 through 12, and also Ezekiel chapter 32, 11 through 16. And then you can read about the fact that one day Egypt is going to submit to Yahweh and going to worship the God of glory. Let me read that to you. This is a beautiful passage here. This has not been fulfilled yet. I believe that this will occur in what we call the millennium, when Jesus is going to rule and reign for 1,000 years. But Isaiah chapter 19, and then let me read you verse 18. It says, "In that day shall 5 cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan, and swear to the Lord of hosts, one shall be called the city of destruction. In that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be a sign for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt, for they shall cry unto the Lord because of their oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And the Lord shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know the Lord in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. Yea, they shall vow a vow unto the Lord and perform it. And the Lord shall smite Egypt, he shall smite and heal it, and they shall return even to the Lord, and he shall be entreated of them and shall heal them." Now, incidentally, Egypt today is primarily Muslim, although there are some, Coptic Christians and others, but primarily they don't know God as a nation. But it says in verse 23, "And in that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and so on and so forth." And then it talks about this in verse 25. It says, "Whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance." So God is going to win the Egyptians onto himself. He's going to call them his people. And we know in the Old Testament, he certainly did not call them his people. He often judged them, and they were involved in demonology. Now, finally, Egypt often in the Bible is a type of the world, or a picture of the sinner under the clutches of the devil. We read in Exodus chapter 13 and verse 3, Egypt is called a house of bondage. And then in Revelation chapter 11, verse 8, it talks about Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. Revelation 11, verse 8, of course, Jesus was crucified in Jerusalem, but it's just pointing to Egypt as being a type of the world, and it was the world that crucified our Lord. Okay, so that's it for Egypt. And now, I'm not sure if this is going to be good news to you or not, but we do need to have a test. This is a rather challenging test, I think, just to be honest with you. It's not impossible or anything like that. It's just you need to study to pass it. And most of you, if you wouldn't study, you wouldn't do very well on it. So I think what we need to do, we need to have it within a week. And the reason why is because a lot of this information, the more that the time goes by, the harder it is to remember some of these points. And it's actually over Babylon, it's over Egypt, it's over Assyria, and it's over Medo-Persia. Now, remember how we would often talk about a Bible custom in between these lands? It's not on any of the Bible customs. It has nothing to do with any of the Bible customs that I talked about. I talked about everyday life in Palestine. I talked about hospitality. It's not on any of those things. It's only on these lands that we've talked about. So it starts with a section on Babylon and goes down through Babylon to, what was the next country we talked about? Persia? Was it? No, okay, good. Assyria. We talked about Assyria. Then we talked about Medo-Persia. And then we jumped back in time and we talked about Egypt. So what you want to do now, you want to look through your notes, you want to read, you know, what we said about this. If I mention any kings and I said put a star beside them, make sure that you know them and the key thing connected with them. If I mention an archaeological discovery and I wrote the name down on the board, then you want to know the major primary thing about that discovery. Like, for example, the Rosetta Stone, the main significance of that is the fact that it's the key that was used to unlock the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, see? And that's all. That's all you need to know. You don't need to know who discovered it. You don't necessarily need to know the year it was discovered, but just the primary thing connected with it. Okay. So we'll have that. Let's see. What would be better, Thursday or Friday?
Friday?
Okay, we'll have it on Friday then. And remember, we've got that assignment. You're probably about done with that, though, aren't you? That assignment? Isn't that due on the 14th? 15th? Is that on a Friday? That's a. Would it be better to have the test on Thursday then?
No.
Okay, well, we'll have the test and the assignment due on Friday. Now, what you don't want to do now, you don't want to wait until the night before and try to do both. It's hard to kill two birds with one stone when it's a bird like that. So don't wait until the night before. Try to get started on it now. The assignment, really, I'm only looking for about maybe a total of 6 hours total work in the library, really. I'm not looking for like 20 hours, 30 hours of research. If you're real diligent and you go in, if you spent 2 hours, 3 hours of diligent work looking up these Canaanites that I gave you, writing a few brief things down about them, and if you wrote it neatly down on a piece of paper or typed it, that should take you only about 6 to 8 hours all total. If you work real diligently and don't talk to other people or wander around or anything like that. But please, don't wait until the night before. Oh, I did that several times before I finally said, this is it, no more night before. You know, Lord, just purge me of this procrastination. Get it out of my life. And I know that life tumbles in. Life never knocks on the door and says, hello, can I come in? Life breaks the door down and tumbles in. And all of a sudden, life is there in glowing color, living colors right before you. And the due date is there. And the day of the Lord has come. Okay, well, let's move on. Let's talk about a Bible custom now. Let's switch. We've got only two other nations we're going to talk about, Greece and Rome, but we won't do that today. Let's talk about dress styles for a little bit, as far as Oriental viewpoints on that. Now, you know as well as I do that dress styles in the West undergo a constant change. I mean, you know, just hang around for a couple of years. I look back at the old ties I used to wear, and I used to say, how did I ever wear those? Those things covered half my chest. And they're a big old fat tie like that. I'd never wear one of those today. But you hang around for 10 years, it'll come back in style again. It'll be back in style again. And, you know, the little thin ties, you know, 10 years from now, you'll feel uncomfortable wearing those. Well, that's the same with almost every other facet of our clothing. But it did not happen in the East like this. They did not change their clothing style. It stayed the same for literally thousands of years. And that was based on the viewpoint that it is morally wrong to change anything that is ancient. Anything that is ancient should never be changed. It is morally wrong to change it. In other words, if Grandpa and Grandpa did it that way, and if Great-Grandpa did it that way, and if long-lost so-and-so did it that way, then that is how we must do it. Tradition is a very, very important thing to the Oriental mind. And they would not change their clothing styles. It would stay the same as it had been for hundreds and hundreds of years. Now, there are five or six pieces of Oriental clothing that we read about in the Bible. Let me list them for you. Number one, there was the inner tunic. Tunic is spelled T-U-N-I-C. But the inner tunic. Number two, there was the outer tunic. And if you were wealthy, you would wear this. If you were poor, normally you didn't have it. But the inner tunic, then the outer tunic. And then number three, there was the cloak or the coat. The cloak or the coat that went over the tunic. Number four, the girdle. Now, by the girdle, it's not like what women used to wear. I don't know if they wear them anymore, but it's not a girdle like some women have worn to somehow try to make them look thinner. This is something that both men and women wore. It's talking about a big belt to tie around their garments. Number five is a headdress. Both men and women wore a headdress virtually at all times whenever they went outside. And number six, the sandals on their feet. Although some Palestinians did wear shoes, especially if they were traveling, but sandals. Now, it would be a real mistake to think of their clothing as being real drab. There's a lot of variety in our clothing. We've got all kinds of colors. If you look out here, all kinds of colors, all kinds of different styles and everything. And often we think of their clothing being drab. It really wasn't. They often had elaborate embroidering on their clothing. They were often brightly colored, especially the women's clothing were. However, most of the clothes were very simple in nature, and most of them were homemade. Very few were purchased or bought from someone else. Let's go back through and talk about each one of these garments real briefly. First of all, let's begin with the outer garment or the mantle. The outer garment or the mantle or the cloak. Now, basically what this was, it was little more than a square of fabric with a hole in the middle for the wearer's head. Kind of like if you were to take a blanket and just cut a hole right in the middle of it to put your head through, like a poncho almost. That's basically all it was. Just a square piece of clothing, although it did vary. And it would fit very loosely around them, like a modern dressing gown or maybe like a bathrobe without being open in the front, although sometimes they were open in the front. But very often it was just a square cloth made out of wool or something like this, and it could be made out of goat's hair, and it was square like that, and it would fit around them very, very loosely. Often made of wool, sometimes of goat's hair, sometimes it was made of cotton, just depending on how much money you had and how much money you could afford to buy the material. Purple was the prized color of the Israelites. It was their favorite color. It was highly prized by the Canaanites as well. There was a certain dye, and it was this purple dye, and they got it from what was called a murex shellfish. Murex rhymes with purex. Spelled like this. And it was a little snail. It's spelled M-U-R-E-X. And they would take these snails, and they would put them together in a big bucket or trough or something, and they would crush them. And when they crushed them, there was this purple juice that came from them, and it was a purple dye. And they would take their garments, and they would put them in this purple dye, and it would dye their garments, and they could manufacture purple in various shades, just depending on their skill. And it was a very permanent dye, very beautiful dye. And so the cloak was a very, very important garment. In fact, it was a primary garment. You needed to have your cloak. And also the cloaks could be dyed in a variety of other vivid colors as well. They could dye them with stripes on them, just depending on the wearer's financial status. A gentleman would never enter the temple without wearing a proper cloak. It'd kind of be like us coming to church with a t-shirt on, without a suit coat and a tie on, see? And so whenever they entered the temple, they always had their cloak on, and it was their prized garment. It was the thing that they had outwardly. It was something that was visibly seen. It was connected with status. It was connected with a certain amount of prestige, and often it was the focus of considerable personal pride. You could look at someone and you could see by the cloak that they had on, he's well-to-do. He's a businessman. He's a financier. He's someone that has a lot of money. Or you could look at him and say he's a pauper, doesn't have any money, just by the cloak that he had on him. Well, when Jesus made his triumphant entry into the streets of Jerusalem, there were those who lined the streets with their garments, with their cloaks. And they laid them down along this pathway, and it was a gesture of honor. And that would be like you taking your suit coat off and laying it on the ground and letting the pastor walk on top of it. And they were really honoring Jesus. Now, unfortunately, they were only honoring him with their outward deeds. They weren't really honoring him with their heart. But you can read about that in Matthew chapter 21 and verse 8. Matthew chapter 21, verse 8. And then later on, when Paul wrote to Timothy, and Paul is in Roman prison at this time, he asked Timothy to bring a couple of cherished possessions. And if you remember the passage, it included, number one, some parchment scrolls, probably copies of the Word of God to read. And this is found in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 13. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 13. But then there was a second thing that he called for. Remember what it was? It was a cloak. It was a cloak. And the reason why, that the evenings in that Roman prison got very cold, and the cloak would double as a blanket. And so Paul obviously was without a cloak, without a blanket, and he's asking Timothy to bring him his favorite cloak, probably. Well, then I think of Matthew chapter 5 and verse 40. Once we understand the value of this outer garment, you can really see the significance of what Jesus is telling his followers to do. This is a high calling here for them to fulfill. We look at it, we say, no big thing, simple thing. But what we need to see is that the average Palestinian, he lives on what we would call today the poverty level. I mean, the average person, like you and me, if we were living back during that time, we would be living from hand to mouth. We'd have the garments on us and maybe a change at home, but we would not have a lot more than that. But in Matthew chapter 5, verse 40, Jesus said, "And if any man will sue you at the law and take away thy coat," and the coat is talking about the inner tunic, "if any man will sue thee," and this is what they would do. If you owed someone else money and you couldn't pay them money, they'd take you to court, and they would sue you for your inner tunic. They'd sue you for the clothes that you had on. And they would take that inner tunic from you. You know what Jesus said here, down in verse 40? Jesus said, "Let him have thy cloak also." Even though he's not suing you for the cloak, give him your cloak also. Offer him your outer garment. Now, Jesus knew how much that meant as far as a personal possession. That's like you parting with your car, almost. This was that valuable to them. This was everything to them. I mean, they wore their cloak. It was their prestige. It was their blanket at night. Very often at night, they didn't have a separate blanket. They would lay down in their house. They'd take their cloak off and cover up with their cloak. And so what Jesus is saying is that you are to voluntarily surrender your cloak as well if someone takes you to the law court. And what he's saying is that there is the law of love that needs to come into operation in your life, in which your personal rights are secondary to other people's needs and desires. And if someone asks you for your inner tunic and they have a right to it, then offer them your cloak as well. And so that would really equate to us that if someone is in a need and they ask you for a real need, give them above and beyond what they are asking. And I feel a lot of times we're not really practical in our Christianity. It's kind of like our Christianity is hypothetical. But the Christianity that Jesus laid down, it's not hypothetical, it's practical. And Jesus was saying, now, when someone stands in need, you give them even your cloak. You offer even your cloak onto them, which would have been a very, very big gift to offer someone. Well, there was also a temptation to strut around with your impressive robe on. I mean, this would be a very, very hard temptation, and for some it was too hard to resist. And some would strut around with their robes on, kind of like someone driving around in their Mercedes-Benz, you know, with their name on the license plate, like people do. And there's a certain amount of prestige with that, you know. I mean, you pass someone like they're standing still on the highway, and the prestige that is connected with that. Well, the religious scribes would often do this. And they often had certain garments that were ostentatious in nature. And you could look at their cloak and you could say, aha, there is a scribe, there is a Pharisee. And Jesus rebuked them for that in Luke chapter 20 and verse 46. Luke chapter 20, verse 46. And the reason why, they looked so good on the outward, but on the inside, see, they did not really care for other people. And then what the Pharisees did, God commanded the Jews to make little blue tassels or a hem on the bottom of their garments. Just little blue hems there. And when they would see that on their cloak, that was to remind them of the law of God. So what the Pharisees did, they made broad the hems of their garments. They made them real big. So that when you saw them, you knew instantly, that's a Pharisee. There's a person that keeps the laws of God. And Jesus came and Jesus rebuked them as well. That's seen in Matthew chapter 23 and verse 5. Matthew 23, verse 5. And the reason why is because many of them were trying to impress men outwardly, you see. And I'm afraid that sometimes as Christians, we can fall into the same trap. We're impressing people with our nice clothes, and we're impressing people with how we look outwardly. But it's not the outside that really matters, it's the inside. Now, the most cruel cloak that was ever put on a man was probably the purple robe that was placed on Jesus. That was a cloak that the Roman soldiers put on Jesus. And they put it on him in mockery. They took this purple robe, and it was a cloak, and they put it on the Savior in John chapter 19 and verse 2, and they put a staff in his hand, and they said, now we bow down before you, prophesy over us and do miracles. And they spat on him, and they slapped him in the face, and they put a crown of thorns on him. And even though it indicated royalty, it still was really a demonstration of contempt for Messiah. And one day they'll stand before him, and he's not going to have that purple robe on. The Bible talks about the white linen robe that he has on in the book of Revelation, with a golden ephod on him, with the feet like burning fine brass, with his hair white as the Ancient of Days, with his eyes burning like coals of fire, and they'll stand before him. And on that day, they're not going to mock him. And they are going to say, hail, thou King of the Jews, but it won't be in contempt on that day. So this cloak then was really, really a big thing. Now, you see, most of us, we take our clothing for granted. And we go to our closet, and we look in our closet, and we choose maybe one of maybe, you know, several coats that we have. They went to their closet and chose their cloak. And that's it. And they went out their house with their cloak. And the next day, for variety, they chose the same cloak. And the next day, the same one. And the same one after that. They only had one cloak. So it was really a big thing to them. And I can really appreciate this. I remember being backpacking one time and being way out in the Rocky Mountains and losing my coat. Could not find it anywhere. And it snowed. And by the time I got out of there, and it took me a couple days, I valued that coat. Valued that coat. You better believe it. Walking around with a sleeping bag draped over my shoulders. Not the way to walk. Poor, poor cloak a sleeping bag is. Okay, you may be excused.
Hi.
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, well, I can't give you the exact date. We were through one-third of the term the last break. When we had that week-long break, that was one-third of the term over. And we've gone, what, 3 weeks since that break, maybe? Okay, well, I think we have...